Hello. Okay, recording is on now. Hello.
Hello.
Hello, Michelle.
Hi, I'm sick. I don't think I'm going to be able to input very much for this. I have read most of what came through. But I'm sorry, I was away all last week. Both our parents in England are not very well, so it's been rather tiring, and I'm now sick. So I have things to add, but I don't think I'm going to be able to add very much this evening. I think I'm going to have to email in a couple of days when I'm feeling better.
Oh, I'm so sorry you're not feeling better.
Oh, we've got somebody else anyway.
Yeah, somebody else is here. Well, do you want to stay on a little bit, or do you want to go now then?
I'll start off listening, but it is being recorded, and if I'm beginning to fade, I'll listen to the recording afterwards.
Sure, sure, okay. Hello, did somebody else join?
Yes, Michael.
Hi, Michael.
How are you guys doing?
Michelle was just saying that she's not feeling very well, so she may listen a bit and I guess may depart and then she'll listen to the call and recording. Did somebody else just join us?
I did. This is Marjorie.
Hi, Marge. I suspect that we're all here because we got regrets from Phil and Candace and Esma.
Oh.
I think that I've got everybody. Is that right?
Yeah.
I think so.
Okay. This call is being recorded, so anybody who wants to can, who's not attending now, can play the recording back later and listen to what we say. I suggest that maybe the first thing that we should do, since I've had the floor before, is give Michael the floor. And Michael, maybe you could tell us about the material that you've sent.
Sure. I did this in obviously a little more rushed fashion than Don's memo. He framed it a little bit. He framed it nicely. So this is really just the nuts and bolts of the simulation, in my mind, of like what each calculation is doing. Mm-hmm. So again, my understanding is that the goal is to estimate the impact of one specific method of teaching or one difference in a pedagogical style versus another one, treatment A and treatment B, if we want to call it that. And so what I did is just kind of think about, you know, what is each variable that we're going to be gathering and how is that variable constructed in the simulation. Feel free to stop me at any point as you have questions. So the first thing is to generate a pre-score because that's what everything is based on.
Mm-hmm.
The pre-score, I said, you know, we can either make it some uniform variable from 1 to 7 to simulate what the SAT scores are, the subscales. We could make it a discrete number from 1 to 7 if we want to make it an actual question from SATs, but I think we agreed in general we're looking at the subscales, which are a summary of a number of the questions.
Yep.
I guess technically they can't be a continuous variable because there's only certain values it could take. Because it's the average of six numbers or something. So
but
anyway.
They're not all the same number of things they're average, are they?
But it still should be a discrete number. Anyway, you know, however we choose to do it, my guess is the results won't be highly sensitive to that decision. You know, whether we use a uniform or a normal distribution might be a bit different.
Mm-hmm.
I agree. The SAT scores tend to look peaked in the middle.
Yeah, I agree. You know, so we can play with that a little bit. You know, and I listed the means and standard deviations from a data set that I was looking at. I know it's not the same data set that some other folks were looking at. This is a subset of the data that I had created for some of the stuff that Phil and I were doing.
Mm-hmm.
So these numbers probably are not too far off, but might not match exactly from what we've seen before. You know, and obviously we can decide on what numbers we want to use for a simulation.
And that would be sensible to go with Candace's selection.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think we should probably go with that.
Yeah.
We should probably go with that. You know, and in any case, we can try different, you know, values of the mean or standard deviation and then decide what to do. The one thing I think is important is to make sure that we make them real numbers by truncating at 1 and 7. Clearly, we don't want numbers beyond that, but we do have to think about, does that put undue weight on those truncated values?
Well, Michael, I think we should do one that's truncated, but we should also do one that's just standard normal, so that if we generate an article from this, we can say, if you've just got standard normal or something close to that, here's what you get. And we also did truncated because the SAT scores are truncated.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. The standard normal makes it more generalizable.
Yeah.
And that's all right. Yeah, maybe we try it both ways. You know, and
yeah,
that's good. It probably is worthwhile trying it both ways. I like that.
Yeah, I did both in the stuff I was playing with Marjorie's data.
Okay, great.
So I think there's something to be said for doing that. It was quite instructive.
Okay. All right. So then the next is the post scores. So assuming there's no difference, then the post score should just be essentially the same as the pre-score plus some error term. We're assuming that there's a perfect correlation there. If we want to assume a different correlation, I guess I'm missing a term in that model. Post should be...
You won't have a perfect correlation because you've got the error. And then depending on the variance of the error...
Yeah, but a relationship of if you know post on average, you can predict the pre to be the same.
Oh, okay, your standard coefficient would be one.
Exactly.
Yeah, okay.
But exactly.
My question is, isn't part of what we're assuming is that there is a covariance or a correlation between the pre and the post? And how are you going to introduce that?
Yeah, so that's that second model where it says pre plus error.
Post is
equal to R times pre, where R is the correlation between pre and post.
That first one does have a correlation between the pre and the post. Depending on how big the variance of the error is versus the variance of the pre, that will decide your correlation. Only I think I'm too tight to get into the nitty-gritty, but you will figure
out. If your error is zero,
then it'll have perfect correlation.
If your error is huge, you'll have zero correlation.
Yes, but if your error is relatively small compared with the variance of the pre, you could have a very high correlation.
Right.
It'll just depend on the relative value.
There's a program for generating correlated scores with any correlation. So,
however, you can get the correlations different ways. You can get the correlation by setting up an error that's independent of the pre, or you can get one where it's not independent of the pre. You could also get it by adding an error to both the pre and the post. My brain's not working very well. If you essentially think there's like a real pre and post, but we're measuring them with error, you can think of your pre that's being measured as the pre plus a small error, and then the post is the pre plus an independent error plus, again, a measurement error, and you will get a correlation between them, and you'll get that the difference is correlated with the pre, which is what we're seeing in the data.
Yeah, I agree. I think we also want to put into that, though, a constant, which is the overall mean of post as well, so that we can factor out that.
You can just add that in, and it's not going to have a huge effect on the results. It'll just mean when you do your confidence intervals, they're either centered around zero or centered around
right. But if we're looking to see how accurate those confidence intervals are in the end, that'll be something we want to look at. So I would say we probably want to look at post equals a constant plus a function of the pre, which talks about that relationship, plus the error, which will dictate how high the correlation is as well.
Yeah.
Well, there is an algorithm for generating the post that you just plug the correlation in and it generates it.
Yeah, but unless we know what the algorithm is. I mean, there's several different algorithms
you could
use.
The memo I sent.
Your algorithm, I think, was the correlation times the pre plus the standard error of the pre, which is 1 minus the correlation squared. Is that right? Is that the one you're talking about?
That's not the standard error of the pre. 1 minus the correlation squared is not the standard error of the pre, but yes, that's the formula.
It's the standard error of the correlation. The square root of 1 minus r squared is the standard error of the correlation.
Oh, I didn't know that. But yes, anyway, that's the formula. And if you multiply that by a random variable, square root of 1 minus the square of the correlation plus the correlation times the pre-score, you get the post-score with the correlation that you want. Now, we don't need to talk about the details of that formula, but that formula is a very easy way to generate the post-score from the pre-score and get the correlation you want.
So I think based on what Michelle said, if I'm understanding it correctly, and I'd have to sit down with it a little more, that it's really only that error term that's going to dictate the correlation.
Yes. You can get any correlation you want on that pre plus error, depending on how big the standard deviation of your error is.
Correct.
But you also have to decide if your error should be independent of the pre-score or whether it should depend on the pre-score.
Right, and I think that that's why...
If it depends on the pre-score, you'll get the regression to the mean thing, or what is apparently a regression to the mean.
Right, and so I think we want to choose a correlation of zero just as a trial.
I agree.
As one of our parameters.
Yes.
You're saying you should have a correlation of zero between the post and the pre?
I think that we should do it so that we can show the impacts when there are no relationships.
I agree.
I agree with you. I think it's not a realistic case. But I think demonstrating the fallacies in a realistic case.
I get what you're saying.
Case are helpful.
You're saying that basically it's kind of arbitrary what the score comes out to be.
And we should do it with a set of correlations, and one will be zero, and I suppose we could go all the way up to 0.95 or 1, but we should do it with a set.
Right.
In making it 1, because...
Yeah, it's not much point in making it 1, because then they're the same.
Right. All right, so I'll need to modify a little bit of what my suggestions were based on what we're talking about now.
Suggestions are great. We're just saying the could.
Yeah, no, I'm kind of keeping my mind on that while we're doing both at the same time. But so the next line for mine is looking at the post scores, assuming that there's an additive impact of the intervention, and that's that eta term.
Yep.
So if there's an additive impact, we add eta. Now, clearly we're going to have issues here of if we're looking at a SATS model, if you start at 7.0, eta has to be zero. So we need to figure out, you know, or eta could be negative.
So is
but it we need to figure out what reasonable values are for eta.
I think you have to put something in and then just truncate so it ends up between the 1 and the 7. Because that's what would happen in real life. That 7 could be, I mean, in some sense, 7, 8, 9, or 10, because we can't measure above 7.
Right.
And some people who are very strongly will be in other words, it will be hard to change their mind, and some people on a 7... you find that you could move them more easily. So in a sense, 7 means 7 and above.
Yeah, I mean, I think to Don's point, I think maybe we should just treat this as a general case with no truncation and then look at the specifics of the SAS case where the truncation exists.
Scale and truncate it.
Yeah. You know, for me, the other piece that I wanted to bring in was that next line, which is the post scores assuming a percentage impact.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is that discussion we were having at JSM about, you know, if you take the function of the pre, which is 7 minus pre, which is the amount of potential increase you have, or pre minus 1, which is the potential decrease that you have, perhaps we can make a parameter on that.
Yes.
And I think what would be really interesting from that, what would be a nice contribution is, what if there is a percentage increase? How is that measured as an additive increase?
I don't understand how is that measured. Isn't it measured?
So if the model, if the model used to estimate the impact is an additive model, but the true relationship is a percentage relationship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what's going to go wrong?
What's going to go wrong? And this, I think, gets to one of Candace's big concerns about the validity of the measure. So she keeps saying, and I think very correctly, you know, is change score valid? Is not something we can answer just based on simulating change scores. But I think we can say that if the true impact, and this is an if that doesn't you know, consider the whole world, but if the true impact is through a percentage change and the additive model can detect it under certain conditions, then we could show, aha, we have a, I'm not going to say in absolute terms, but a more valid measure. You know, because the additive...
Do you think we should start saying appropriate, not valid, and then we won't be confusing Candace by having
valid? That's true.
We'll just try and say... I was thinking all day, what word could we use? And I thought, well, maybe appropriate would do.
Well, except that validity is a, you know, a term
commonly
used.
Yeah, I know.
So.
But it's kind of... Because the word validity has got these two different contexts in stat ed, it gets quite confusing.
Well, if we say valid for and fill in the blank after the for, maybe that makes it reasonable.
Well, I mean, you know, for me, I would ask, is change scores a valid measure when the true relationship is percentage?
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, because for me, that makes it very clear about what is the true relationship and what does your measure do.
Well, you have to add a little bit to that, Michael. Is change score a valid measure for comparing two groups rather than just saying a valid measure? Because you could also use the measure just as a descriptive statistic. And Candace might argue that as a descriptive statistic, it can't be used, but it might be valid for comparing two groups.
Agreed.
So you have to add that for, valid for this or valid for that.
Yeah, agreed. I think that perhaps our challenge in the end will be taking the 70-word-long sentence that we're creating to define valid and shrinking it down to something that can be comprehended by people.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
So, great. So, either there's an additive or a percentage effect, depending on how we want to define it.
Mm-hmm.
Then I started introducing these covariates.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought about a covariate that's uncorrelated called CoView, or
mm-hmm.
a covariate that's correlated that's a function of the pre.
Mm-hmm.
And what I did is look at cognitive competence versus GPA,
mm-hmm.
and found that there was a relationship, although not significant, we could still model it, a relationship between GPA and cognitive competence. The higher your GPA, the higher your pre-cognitive competence.
Mm-hmm.
In addition, when you look at all of it together, the change in cognitive competence is also a function of GPA. So that implies that there is some interaction effect that we need to model as well.
There's a significant...
It's not significant,
oh, okay.
But it's present.
Yeah.
You know, so it might be zero and we just happened to get a sample that showed us a positive effect. I'm fine with that. But I think for the simulation, we should assume that there might be an interaction effect.
Yeah, now, we should start simple. We've got a list of about 8 or 10 extensions that we can do to this, various extensions. And we should start simple, but then we can maybe make the list of extensions and pass it around to everybody and vote on which extensions we want to do, because we're going to have many, many, many conditions if we're not careful. For example, adding covariates is yet another condition that we're going to add. We're going to start out, of course, presumably without any covariates, but then we can add covariates. But that's another condition that we're examining.
Yeah, I mean, you know, my feeling is that if we develop a large model, you know, a single equation model that we're all, you know, or maybe one or two models, if we talk about a percentage versus additive change, if we talk about one or two models that's kind of encompassing everything, and then we allow all the parameters to change,
mm-hmm.
so that we can blank out any of those
right.
effects that we don't want to include
It's a big simulation, though, if you're going to vary all those things. We've got to do all these things in a simulation.
I agree, although my experience from doing simulations is that the marginal cost of adding a little bit more is
mm-hmm.
not that much.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, you have one lot of code, and then you'll just zero parts of it out.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, that's fine with me. It's my plan to make a list of all of these conditions that we're talking about, and then we can perhaps vote on which ones we want to include in the simulation.
Yeah, I guess my image is we have a really complicated model that we start with, but that complicated model has a parameter for the interaction effect, call it gamma, and we allow gamma to be zero for some situations,
mm-hmm.
in which case we're not including that.
Yeah.
And we could, for the sake of explanation, talk about a reduced model based on
mm-hmm.
those parameters. But that will allow us, as you know, the most robust potentials.
Okay. Somebody's
you know, but I agree. But maybe we do two approaches. Maybe we just start the simple approach and just do the basics, and then do the full model with all the caveats.
Yeah, it makes sense from a certain logical building point of view to start simple, but leave.
Yeah, no, I agree. I agree, and that's how you're going to code it that way. You're going to start simple and then build. But,
yeah.
And then, so I guess then, for me, the other question came about of what statistics are we using to assess how good a model is? And I threw out a few possibilities of the mean bias, the standard deviation bias, and the coverage probability. So the mean bias is we have an estimated value. Because this is a simulation, we have a true value,
yeah.
and we see how far off they are from each other.
Mm-hmm.
The standard deviation of that, same logic. The coverage probability is a nice one. You calculate a 95% confidence interval for an estimate and then look at what percent of the time did you actually contain the true value. And it should be equal to the confidence level. You know, a 95% confidence interval should contain it 95% of the time.
I'm just going to suggest that you, because I know that, Don, I didn't read your most recent file. I just haven't had time. I saw Michael's because it was so short, I was able to give it a quick read through.
Sure.
But I know that the original one we talked about, you know, when you want to check if it's uniform or not. And I look back to when I'd done this before. And way back, 1999, in the Journal of, I know, Statistical Computing and Simulation or something, I had a paper where we did this with robust methods to compare them under the null hypothesis, how they worked. Some of them were dreadful, by the way. And a couple of the things we did was, and this will be very similar to what you just said about the confidence level, Michael, was we compared all the nominal 5% levels, and actually we just did plots of what their actual levels were, which made it really very easy to see where some methods were obviously much more true to what it should be than others.
Mm-hmm.
And also, if you've saved your p-values, you can do a QQ plot, and then it's really obvious whether things are matching up or whether, you know, which way around it's deviating off.
I agree. Now, Michael, you didn't mention p-values at all, looking at the p-values from these analyses.
Oh, it's analogous to the coverage probability because you're calculating a confidence interval.
Okay, yeah. That's why you didn't mention p-values.
But I think it's kind of cool to do both because it's so easy to do that QQ plot.
Uh-huh.
And it's very easy because it's like a binomial. You can also do... You can do a confidence interval on the true level for a nominal 5% level very easily as well.
Uh-huh.
I tend to favor p-values because confidence intervals can't be used in more complicated situations. So, and p-values can be used all over the place.
Okay. Well, I'm actually totally in favor of confidence intervals as well. I just like to see the p-value in there because it's so easy to do these QQ plots and check out that binomial thing. I know because I've done it before.
I mean,
it's
really
quick and it gives you such a nice plot. I've done stuff like this with confidence intervals as well because I've done a lot of bootstraps.
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, I'm also, I would do both. I think it's nice to have something about, and obviously they're going to match up. The 5%
sure.
P-level and the coverage probabilities are going to be totally related. It's just some people relate easily to one and some to the other. And
that makes sense. People
great.
Don't like it both ways.
Great. So, and then the last piece for my, you know, simulation suggestion memo is saying, okay, what are we actually modeling? So we're talking about an estimate versus a true value. The true values are easy. How are we obtaining the estimates? And I suggested that we might do it in five different ways. The first is just look at the wrong, acknowledged to be wrong model, where we calculate the post from treatment A minus the post from treatment B.
Yes.
And we should be able to show, as a sanity check for our models, that it's always a bad thing to do that. Then we say, okay, what if we look at the change of A versus the change in B and compare that to the actual change? Then we look at the percentage increase, and that will allow us to compare what's the impact in the percentage model when we have an additive relationship or vice versa. Then we compare beta. It should have said eta.
Oh, okay.
It should have said eta, which is the true effect.
Yep.
Compare the true effect from the models, you know, including a regression coefficient when we have modeling. And then if we're including the interaction effect, be it with regression or ANCOVA, whatever, we also have an estimate of eta. Maybe we just want to look at the eta. Because if we're doing eta and gamma, which is the interaction effect.
Aren't we? On some of these, I'm going to have to go in a minute because my brain's really going. Aren't we going to? Oh, no, you're using the post. All right.
I guess I'd have to think about that a little more. Do we just want to look at eta, which is the main impact we're looking at?
Then I don't think it's going to measure what we hope it's going to measure. But I will let you know that my head's very fuzzy today.
You don't think the eta is going to measure?
I'm not sure it measures because, well, it's going to depend on that covariate as well, isn't it?
But if we
depend on beta, the beta and the covariate as well.
But if we create the data using a model that includes a main effect from the covariate and an interaction effect of the covariate with pre, and we model it using both of those terms, shouldn't we get exactly the same effect? Isn't that the idea of it? If we use a model to evaluate the data the same way that we generated the data, we better get.
I understand what you're saying. Well, obviously you will. It would be very worrying if you didn't.
So that can be the sanity check to make sure that the program is working right. And then we can say, okay, how large do these parameters have to get before the impact is really meaningful?
I'm going to have to go. I've got my breathing problem again. I'm really sorry.
All right, feel better.
If you record the rest of the phone call, I'll listen in.
You're feeling
better. Feel better.
All right, thanks. All right.
Oh, boy.
Okay,
that didn't sound so good.
No.
She didn't sound so alarmed, so I guess that's a good sign.
Yeah. Okay. Carry on, Michael.
So, you know, so I was saying that I think that if we generate the data using a complex model, but use that complex model to evaluate the data, we better get unbiased estimates.
Yeah.
If we start introducing those parameters in various orders of magnitude where there, you know, but model it ignoring the complicated effect, we can quantify how much bias there is in the model.
Mm-hmm.
To me, that's the goal of the simulation.
Pardon me?
To me, that's one of the goals of the simulation.
To quantify the bias?
To quantify the bias when you have modeled it in a way that wasn't used to generate the data.
When you've got an inappropriate model, yeah.
Correct.
Less,
you know, or how large should the correlation be before you have to start being concerned about something?
Okay.
You know, clearly a correlation of zero, you don't need to worry about that issue. A correlation of 0.1, you probably don't have to worry about it. By the time you get to 0.5, you probably do.
So what you're saying is that, you know, if we just look at comparing the change scores to the change scores, like in, I'm looking, these should be done under the following models. And so where you have B compare change to paint, change A minus change B.
Right.
If it turns out that we have a lot of bias there, we might be able to quantify that bias. Is that what you're talking about? That we might be able to.
So my claim, if we're looking at B, for example, the change model, then I think if we generate the data
mm-hmm.
based on the impact only being an additive effect of the change, then we should get an unbiased estimate.
Okay.
If we generate the model, assuming there's that, for example, percentage increase, not an additive increase.
Yeah.
How high must that percentage increase be before the additive model picks it up?
Okay.
So, for example, if the percentage change is 1%, so you're moving from a 6 to a 6.01.
Yeah.
There's nothing there. My claim is the additive model will be sufficiently robust to pick up that almost zero difference.
Uh-huh.
When the percentage is 100%, will the additive model pick it up?
Okay.
Maybe, but what will the estimate be? Right? That's the question that this can answer.
Okay.
Okay, well, that makes sense to me, too. I think you and I, Michael, are looking at this from a slightly different perspective, but we're really got the same goals in mind.
Yeah, I think the big picture is in sync.
But just let me double check on that. One of my main interests is to either confirm or disconfirm that the analysis of change scores is appropriate when you're trying to compare two approaches to teaching. Either we want to say in the kind of the last sentence, it is appropriate to analyze change scores if you're comparing two teaching approaches, or we might say it's not appropriate to analyze change scores if you're comparing two teaching approaches. We might also want to say that analysis of change scores is more powerful or less powerful or about the same power as analysis of covariance for detecting differences in two teaching approaches. Are you in agreement with that?
I think I am, but I would add the condition of what the underlying models are.
Yes.
Change scores are appropriate for measuring, you know, increase from one group to the other when something's present.
Yeah, when there's just an additive change, we might say they're appropriate, but they're not appropriate if there's a percentage change, or they might be appropriate in both cases.
Or, I mean, it would be wonderful if we could say the additive model is still appropriate even when there's a percentage change. Now, I don't think that's going to be true under all conditions, but we could answer the question under certain conditions that we're going to discover. The additive model is still valid for the percentage model. When the data are really following a percentage model behind the scenes, if you model it with an additive model, under certain conditions, is it still valid? That, I think, would be a phenomenal finding.
Well, now, I'm a little puzzled there. When you talk about the model, you're talking about doing an analysis, of course. And you have
Yeah, so there's two models. There's the model that generates the data, and there's the model that analyzes the data.
And so supposing you generate the data with a percentage model, as
yep.
you're suggesting, how would you analyze the data with a percentage model? Because you're just comparing the two teaching approaches and looking for a difference, I would think, in the means between the SAT scores for those two approaches.
I think that, you know, if you look at the factor – what I had said in that model is if you calculate the potential increase as that function of pre, f of pre.
Are you talking about the generating model or the analysis model?
The generating model.
Okay, yeah.
That f of pre is the potential gain.
So
if you start off at a 5, if your pre is 5, f of pre is 2 because you can go up to 2 points.
Okay.
You can then calculate the percentage as the actual amount that they went up divided by 2. So if they went 5 to 6, that's a 50% increase.
I'm sorry. I misunderstood. You're talking about computing percentage change prior to the analysis and then analyzing percentage change.
Correct.
Yeah,
so my understanding of what's happening is we have full control over the models that we choose to analyze these data. We have no control over the true underlying models. We don't know how the data were really created. What were they really correlated to? What's really impacting the results?
I agree.
So what we want to do is simulate all the possible combinations in theory,
mm-hmm.
or as many as we can think of, simulate combinations for the generating model, and then say, in the analytic model, how good were they?
How good were they at?
How good were the analysis model at getting us unbiased estimates that of the difference that we're looking at. So you know, how accurate is the gain score to estimate the true difference that exists?
Okay.
So, for example,
if we're doing an analysis, this is not data generation now. We're doing analysis now. And we're going to compute the percentage. There's two ways we can analyze. We can compute the percentage change, or we can compute the absolute change. I think that's what you're saying. These are two ways that we can analyze the data.
Correct.
Okay. Now, just so that I understand, why would you think that the percentage change is an appropriate way to analyze? I'm not challenging it, but I'm just curious. Why is that an appropriate way as opposed to the absolute change?
I don't know whether that's appropriate, but I know that some people do it.
Oh, okay. Then it's sensible to analyze it.
I know that in particular physics educators like Eric Mazur out of Harvard, he looks at the force concepts inventory, which is a measure of, like, how much conceptual understanding students have of forces in a physics class. And he's compared teaching methodologies by looking at the percentage increase of each student, not the additive increase.
I see.
And I have no idea why he chose that.
Yeah.
Is there something theoretically nice about it? Did he wake up one day and say, I need to contribute to the literature? I have no idea.
Yeah.
But given that it's something that people use, we might as well try it.
If people are doing it, we should do it too. And actually, it's an interesting question. Under the various models, which approach is more powerful at detecting change under change due to teaching approaches? Because presumably, either the percentage model or the absolute model, I don't think we should say additive, but absolute, the absolute difference between teaching approach A and teaching approach B as opposed to the it's the increase, isn't it? It's not the difference. It's the increase.
It's the increase, yeah.
Yeah, how much percent you increased or how much in absolute terms you increased.
Yeah, I think Canvas uses gain score.
Yeah. There's a lot of different names, gain and change and increase, I guess. And so one method is going to be more powerful. If you compute the percentage increase or percentage gain or percentage change or the absolute gain, change, or increase, one method is going to be more powerful for a given data generation method. And that's an interesting question to answer. If the data are generated this way, which method is more powerful?
Well, I would assume that the method that aligns to the generation method will be the most powerful. So if you're generating it looking at just gain scores, then doing a model using gain scores is going to be the most powerful.
That makes sense to me.
Right? I mean, intuitively, that would make sense.
Yeah,
the other thing to ask is, okay, if we have a set of different models that could have generated the data, which one is has the largest minimum power?
Yeah, I agree. I agree. These are the kinds of things that educators are going to appreciate if we answer these questions, because they're very general questions. And, of course, they're talking about evidence-based research in education now.
Right.
And so change scores are or change from pre to post, not necessarily with change scores, but change from pre to post is an obvious way to look at it because it's powerful. So a lot of people are going to be interested in what's the best way to analyze this given various models for data generation.
Right.
Okay, well, a question is, where should we go from here?
May I?
Sure.
Let me ask you this question. By any chance, are we going to be assuming that we've got equal sample sizes of our classes? And well, I guess because they're matched pairs. Never mind.
Well, but it actually is an interesting point. I realized I forgot to include this. We talked about maybe assuming missing data. If the data are missing completely at random, it shouldn't affect anything.
Mm-hmm.
If the data are missing as a function of their pre-score, for example. So let's say all the people who have an interest less than 4 in the pre are going to drop the class.
Mm-hmm.
That actually is missing that's correlated with some of the covariates, and that
yeah.
could have a major impact.
Mm-hmm.
So that becomes another dimension that we can vary in the simulation.
But I would think that maybe, just to keep it simple at first, but I do think that that might be something that we may want to write down and not to lose that thought.
Well, it's my plan to make a list of all of the things that we're talking about varying, because we've got a lot of them, and I've got a part of a list going already.
Mm-hmm.
Then maybe we should prioritize the items on the list and decide what we want to vary in the simulation, or maybe we want to vary them all.
Yeah, and I started taking notes of our conversation, but because we were referencing so much of the download of the PDF files, I could not do so. So
This is being recorded, Marge.
Okay, good. I couldn't take any summary notes, and I usually try to do that, but I was unable to do so.
Yeah, well, it'll all be available, although it's a little painful listening to it all again, but it's all available.
I was going to say, in my mind, and again, this is my thinking that may or may not apply to others, what I would like to do is now go back to my memo and update it based
mm-hmm.
on some further thoughts that we've said and send out a summarized version of that.
Good.
That would be very good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd love to spend a little time hearing a little bit about, you know, Don's thoughts, how it is consistent with what we're saying here, any additions, you know, et cetera.
Okay. Well, maybe what I could do is quickly walk people through my memo, you'll know what my thinking is. Have both of you got a copy of my memo there?
Yes, I do.
Michael?
I'm calling it up right now.
Okay.
Can I just report to somebody? We're doing our first group of focus groups tonight. So we're studying students' perceptions of statistics prior to taking the class, and we're doing our first focus group tonight to find out some of that information, and we're videotaping it, and I really am excited. So
excellent, excellent. Now, who's participating in this group? Students are participating?
Students are participating, and I have a student who is working with me on it.
And,
so.
And you're going to present them with a bunch of questions and then just get them to talk.
Right.
Excellent.
Yes. So this is exciting. I do have one question to ask. I am looking for a good math attitudes inventory. I've looked at the AMTI. I'm going to be sending this question to the group and try to get you guys a feedback. The more I look at my data, I think that math attitudes and statistics attitudes are very much related, and I'd like to show that. So
I think you're right. I think that students don't know the difference.
And that's what I'm thinking that some of our focus group is going to find out.
Yeah.
And so, but I just had to share that tonight's our first focus group, and I hope everybody shows up. So
that's great, Barge. How many are you expecting?
Three tonight and three tomorrow.
Excellent.
It's small, but it's a pilot study, so it's a beginning step. So, all right.
Hey, Michael, have you got that memo? You there, Michael?
Yeah, I'm sorry. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yes.
I had to look at something else. I put it on mute for 1 second. I was talking and no one was listening. So I actually am working on an NSF grant that has been recommended for funding with some other folks, and one of the things we're looking at is math attitudes.
Oh, great.
So let's stay in touch about that, and I can look back with some of the math ed folks about what they're planning on using for math attitudes. We might even have something written in the grant about what some of the instruments are.
Because I've been doing some research, but there's a lot of research, and I'm trying to find, you know, what people are most recommending. And I think I have an idea. It may be Tapia's ATMI or something like that, but I would be very much interested. I will talk to Michael separately. I don't want us to get off track.
Yeah.
Okay.
Great.
It makes sense to administer the SATs and a bunch of other tests and see how well they correlate.
Yes.
Yeah.
As long as it doesn't take up so much of the kids' time that they hate us afterwards. I don't know.
Exactly.
Yeah. You've got
a constant balance.
Yeah. Okay. Shall I go through the memo that I sent?
Yes. Or, yes.
Sure.
Okay. On page one, I talk about the goals, and the goal that I'm most interested in, as I've said before, is comparing two teaching approaches to see if one is better than the other and to see what analysis method is preferred in the sense that it is a correct analysis method and which is the most powerful. On page two of the memo, is a program that a person can use to generate correlated scores. And there's lots of versions of this program on the Internet. This seems to be the program that everybody uses to generate correlated scores when you're trying to simulate them. On page three is just...
I think that if I can say, I think we really should at some point have a conversation about what the difference is, because Michelle had claimed that perhaps that correlation times pre-score can just be pre-score, and that if we are only concerned about the variance, that should dictate the correlation. I need to wrap my head around that more, but I think that's what she was claiming.
I think so too. That you can add a number to the, you can add the random variation to the pre-score, and depending on the standard deviation of that random variation, you're going to get a different correlation. However,
so how is that different than the formula that you've given here? I don't know the answer to that, but...
The difference is that the formula that I've given gives you a standard deviation of the post-score that is 1. And Michelle's method, the standard deviation of the post-score will vary.
Still not sure if I see that. I'm going to have to sit down and think about that.
That the formula on page 2 of the memo gives you a standard deviation of the post score that's 1. Look at page 3 of the memo, and you can see this is data, 1,000 data items that I generated with that algorithm, and you can see that the pre-scores and the post-scores have roughly the same standard deviation, and there's a picture of the change scores, too. And I guess they have a standard deviation of around 1 as well. So that algorithm works. According to this little simulation I did. On page 4 of the memo...
But let me ask you that. But how does that first term, so the compute post-score equals correlation times pre-score,
mm-hmm.
What is that correlation doing? Because if we had taken that out and just said post-score equals pre-score plus that same variance term, what's the difference between that
it's
and...
It's showing the linear relationship, because remember, the correlation coefficient is the slope. And so that's a linear relationship between pre-score and post-score, and the multiplying by the correlation coefficient gives you the slope. And so
yeah.
I think you can see that better.
Okay.
On page 4 are some descriptive statistics about those pre-scores and post-scores and the correlations, and you can see on page 4 that the correlation is 0.482, which is close to 0.48, which was specified. And on page 5 is a scatter plot showing the relationship between pre-scores and post-scores, and we see the regression toward the mean because the solid line, which is the regression line, is not quite as steep as the dotted line, which is the line y equals x. Regression toward the mean is seen even better on page 6 because we see that the change score is a decreasing function of the pretest score, which is something, a point that Michelle made earlier, that when you have regression toward the mean, there is a relationship between the change score and the pretest score. The section at the bottom of page 6...
Wait, I'm sorry. Can you wait 1 second? I'm just trying to absorb the last one.
Sure.
So change score on the y-axis, pretest on the x-axis. And so the relationship that we're seeing here is because of that correlation times pre that you put into the equation. Is that correct?
It's because whenever you have correlated variables that have the same standard deviation... Whenever you have correlated variables, unless the correlation coefficient is 1, you have regression toward the mean. And so this decreasing relationship on page 6 comes out automatically from the fact that we have correlated variables. I didn't put that in. It just comes out automatically. That's regression toward the mean. And what you might want to do, Michael, to see that this works is do your own simulation. And you'll get the same graph if you do the same kind of thing as is done on page 2 with the algorithm on page 2.
Right.
I suspect from your code that you're working with SAS.
Correct.
Yeah, because RAND-NOR is a SAS function.
Yeah, correct.
So page 6 is showing standard regression toward the mean. I didn't do anything to put that in. It just comes out automatically, as Michelle pointed out. At the bottom of page 6 is an explanation of an error I made because I thought originally in our phone conversation before that we had to build in regression toward the mean, and we don't. It is all automatically built in for us if we use that algorithm, as shown in the scatter plot at the top of page 6. So once we specify the distribution of the pre-scores and the distribution of the post-scores, and the joint distribution, which is typically bivariate normal, which is sensible, and the correlation coefficient, everything is specified. There's no more degrees of freedom for regression toward the mean or anything else. Those four specifications specify the works. Any questions about that?
No.
Okay.
Still absorbing, but no questions.
On page 7 is pseudocode for doing the simulation, basically you use the algorithm on page 2, or whatever algorithm you prefer to use. The algorithm on page 2 is convenient because you can just plug the correlation coefficient into it, and you generate lots of scores, and then you generate 30 scores for group A and 30 pretest and post-test scores for group B, and you can have either a difference between A and B or not, as you prefer, and then you analyze the scores for that one class, 30 teaching approach A and 30 teaching approach B. You analyze those scores with analysis of covariance, and you get a p-value for the difference between the two groups. And you also analyze the scores with as change scores, and you get a p-value there. And you put those two p-values in a new data set. And so that operation of generating those two p-values and putting them in a new data set, you do that, say, 10,000 times. and you get 10,000 rows in that data set of pairs of p-values, and then you can look at those p-values, look at the distribution of those p-values to see how they're distributed. And, of course, if there's no difference between teaching approach A and teaching approach B, then the p-value should have a uniform distribution. And Michelle was suggesting that you look at PP or QQ plots to see if they actually do have a uniform distribution, because if they have a uniform distribution, then all of the points should be lying on roughly a straight line on one of those plots. So that is the basic idea of the simulation, and of course we can tinker with the simulation by making the various changes that we're proposing. And on page 9 is a list, the start of a list of some of the various differences that we can do to tinker with different ways that we can do it. For example, Michael has suggested that we add another analysis approach, which is percent change. And Michael has suggested that we add covariates. So, and that's not on the list, but we can add that to the list. And let's see what else we have. Oh, yes, we're going to vary the correlation coefficient. And there's suggestions that we do 0.25, 0.5, 0.75, 0.9, and 0.95. There's a suggestion that we maybe try to do more than 10,000 simulations, maybe 100,000, because it does take a while for burn-in to take place where the thing settles down and you get a nice distribution of the p-values. I think item 7 there is a suggestion that Michael made, that we break the scatter plot of post-scores versus pre-scores into a 3x3 array, and we analyze different areas of that array. Suggestion 8 is another suggestion from Michael, that we vary the missing data structure.
Right.
And I guess there are other suggestions in there that I don't need to cover. On page 11 is the question of whether or not we should analyze change scores, but also include the pre-scores as a covariate in that analysis. And
so this is post. This is change
as the response variable or the dependent variable,
and pre as the covariate.
And my sense is that that's not often done, but it'd be fun to try to see what happens.
You know, I think we should at some point look at some of the mathematics of the models and see whether there is a mathematical equivalence to those models.
Although I tend to be more of a simulation person because...
yeah, but that should be just a straightforward calculation.
Yeah, well, then by all means, we should definitely do that. It makes good sense. On page 11, on the middle of page 11, is some comments about Marge's bootstrapping proposal. And at the bottom of page 11 is the question of, it's kind of a related question that we do need to address at some point, is whether or not it's sensible for a teacher who doesn't have a comparison group to do a paired t-test to see if her students' scores got better or worse using a paired t-test as a way of assessing the effectiveness of the course, so that you give students the SAS pretest before the course starts, you give them the post-test, and then you do a paired t-test to see if the value scores got better or worse at the end of the course. And that section there is commenting on the fact that there is from an experimental point of view, a problem with doing that, and that is that you don't know what would have happened to the scores if they hadn't had a statistics course.
Right.
For example, the scores might have got better from a familiarity effect of taking the test twice, or they might get worse from a familiarity effect of taking the test twice. So
yeah, and unfortunately, I think what I've seen, and I think what Marge says as well, is that often scores go down, right?
Well, yeah, and that may be the fact that statistics courses are turning students off, or it may be the fact that the second time you take the SATs, even if you haven't had a statistics course, you do worse on it for some effect due to taking it twice. So it's not...
Why would that be the case? I mean, I know for, like, high-stakes assessment tests, like SATs, if you were to take it twice, there's a practice effect. But why would there be an effect on the SATs?
Well, my intuitions say there should be no effect.
Uh-huh.
However, from a strict experimental point of view, without a control group, you can't say that the scores went down, for example, and therefore we're making students worse.
Yeah.
Probably we are for courses where the scores go down significantly. Probably we're making them worse. But you can't really say that without a control group. Now, the control group that you, if you don't have two teaching approaches, a sensible control group is to find another group of students who are similar to the students who are in your course and get them to take the SATs pre and post, but don't give them a statistics course.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can compare those two groups to see if the course also got worse. Or perhaps I think what's more likely is that they'd stay the same. There'd be no difference. So that the statistics course made them worse. But you can't, without having a control group or something to compare to,
yeah.
say for sure that because the scores went down, that the course made the students worse.
I wonder if we can, this may be a question for Marge, I wonder if we can actually give that to people. So can we in some way to say, here's a bad class. Here's what happened to the SATs.
Well,
here's a mediocre class.
Michael.
Here's what happened to the SATs. Here's a great class. Here's what happened to the SATs. And it'd be interesting to look at the difference effects that good, bad, and mediocre classes have on SATs.
Well, I think we can do that in a slightly different way from what you're suggesting. Of course, it's rather difficult to decide what's a great class.
Exactly. I was just going to say that's the hard part.
Yeah, I don't want to volunteer my class for a bad class. You know.
Well, it's easy. My classes are great.
Way.
That's the metric we'll use.
Okay.
I'm kidding.
And there is another way, and the other way is that we give teachers the average out of the SATs file and say, this is what happens on average. So that and you can do a one-sample t-test against our averages. So, for example, I think value scores and the whole thing went down 0.21 points.
Yeah.
And so you can tell a teacher, you can do a one-sample t-test with your class against the SATs value scores. And if your scores went down significantly more than 0.21, you're doing worse than average.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but then the average is the group of people who volunteered to be part of the SATs in the first place.
Exactly.
Example.
But that's a good point because these are people who are well motivated, and so are trying hard because of the very fact that they're doing the SATs. And so a teacher can compare against them and say, oh my goodness, I'm doing better than these people. Or I'm doing worse than these people.
Or I'm doing about the same.
Yeah.
Well,
because I do think that, I mean, the first time I did the SATs and my value decreased, I thought, oh, my God, what am I doing to my students?
I did the same thing. I was like, oh, my gosh, am I really that bad? Like, all mine went down pretty much.
And then when I learned that's normal,
that
made me feel better.
Yeah, and so we can give teachers the norms, and they can compare their class against the norm.
Mm-hmm.
And if they're way above the norm, they can feel great. If they're below the norm, we can put tactful words to say, well, maybe you should be thinking about ways of changing the course so you can catch up to the norm.
Yeah, but I do think I think one of the end objectives of the SATS project, the collection of this database, is to create norms. I don't believe we've even come close to, I mean, yeah, we've got over 2,000 points, but those 2,000 data points are from such different courses, different places. I think it's going to take us some time before we can actually get norms.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, but what I would like to do, Don, is exactly what you're saying.
Good.
I want to have norms. That's one of the reasons that I started this project, the SATS project of collecting the data to make the database, is that, okay, now what are our norms?
Good. And, well, right now I guess we could publish the numbers that we have and maybe publish their standard deviations or their standard errors. So that people could know how much they tend to vary and
mm-hmm.
say that we only have a small number of data points. But still, if you want, you can compare your class against them,
mm-hmm.
perhaps doing a one-sample t-test. And if you're way below, Well, you might want to think about looking for ways to change the cost, and if you're way above, you might want to publish a paper
mm-hmm.
about what you're doing.
Right.
Because a lot of people, we do have to guide people on how they're going to analyze their classes, their scores, and everybody's going to want to do a one-sample t-test, and we have to tell them the problems with that.
Yeah. I have to go, gentlemen.
Yeah, I do too.
I've got somebody at 4 o'clock who's coughing outside my door right now. And so I've got to go, so I will talk to you guys later. I don't know when the next time we're going to be talking, though.
Why don't we coordinate that on email? Proposing another time, because there's not enough people now here to agree on a time.
Okay.
And we can somehow vote on a time when we can all make it.
Yeah. It may be that December may be getting too crazy. It may be something that we may want to have, like, 2 meetings in January.
In January?
Yeah. Are people going to the joint math meetings? Anybody else going?
I am not.
No,
okay.
I think you're
putting on a presentation there, Michael.
I'm not presenting. I'm moderating.
Oh, good.
Okay.
But
I would think that December, it's the holiday. It's the end of the semester. At least it is for me. I don't know. Californians maybe. You're on term. Is that correct, Michael?
I'm East Coast.
You're East Coast. Why did I think that you were... Never mind.
Phil is Pomona.
Okay.
Yeah, no, we're winding down to the end too. It's definitely getting hectic around here. I got students outside the door as well, waiting to ask questions. So.
Okay, so I'm going to hang up, and we'll set a time either in December or maybe 2 meetings in January, which may be more logical.
Sounds good.
All right. Bye.
All right. Thanks, everyone.
You're off, Michael.
Thank you.